WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. There's perhaps no other profession in which the mind-body connection is as crucial as it is in sports. Many professional teams have a psychologist on staff, but the field of sports psychology is mostly geared toward quick-fix behavioral therapy and performance enhancement. Dr. Michael Miletic takes a different approach. He's a former athlete who's now a psychiatrist, and he's one of the few mental health workers in sports who practices psychoanalysis. Dr. Miletic may spend years with a patient, slowly exploring their past, identifying the traumas that may have led to their current distress. Miletic has been a psychiatric consultant to the parents group of the National Football League Players Association, to several National Hockey League teams, and to the Detroit Pistons. He says he's developing a psychological map of the jock's mind. When we talked last week, Miletic told me about the first professional athlete he worked with.
It happened shortly after my residency in psychiatry in Detroit, where I was called to the bedside in an intensive care unit of a National Hockey League player who had attempted suicide by swallowing a combination of antidepressants and sedatives and other barbiturates in a very serious suicide attempt. And I was called in by the family to consult with this very unfortunate and in fact, life-threatening situation at the time, with the story and history that this was a man that had been spinning out of control for some time and had unexpectedly, to everyone, attempted to take his life as a way to get out of something that felt inescapable to him in his life.
Now, one of his biggest problems was that he had a signature slap shot, and he suddenly wasn't able to hit it, right?
That's true. And that, in fact, was an early part of what he felt to be his decline on the ice, and he felt that this was a signature is a good word because he was known throughout the league as having one of the most powerful shots and able to deliver it virtually on target each time. Symptomatic of some of his problems was the fact that he was unable to hit the net with the same degree of accuracy or any accuracy at all earlier on in the course of his decline.
Now, in your treatment of him, did you work on regaining this key to his game, his slap shot?
There was not a focusing on particular symptoms with this man that I began with, at least. In fact, I began by trying to open up any potential and any possibility of talking about anything with him, rather than focusing on particular symptoms. Instead of focus on symptoms, which I was concerned might narrow the field of his mind, instead we approached it from a point of view of let's open up the field and see just what we can find as much as possible.
After 2 years, you did have a breakthrough in therapy with this this hockey player. How did the breakthrough come about?
Breakthrough, I think, was happening more in my mind than in what was going on between us, because things had moved quite slowly. I just sort of continued the same approach of non-symptom-oriented self-reflection and discussion and interaction between the two of us. And what we stumbled upon in probably a year and a half later was a very traumatic history that this young man had endured. A traumatic history consisting of his being ritually beaten, either with a belt or with some other instrument, by both an uncle and a father, when he was seen as being bad around the house. These memories emerged without much emotion, without much affect attached to them, were given very little significance by him at the beginning, were seen as something both familial and cultural, and so what's the big deal? What's there to think about or talk about? But what I did was to begin to gradually explore the meaning of these beatings to him, and what was very clear to me was that as he would begin to discuss how he was beaten and taken through the different moments of these terrible times to him, he would link them in his mind to his hockey. And particularly what he began to do was to link them temporally to thinking about his slap shot and thinking about collisions and thinking about shooting the puck from the blue line. And what I began to think about was the possibility that this man was experiencing something I'll use a jargon term which doesn't exactly capture the experience, but something of a subliminal emotional flashback, that as he was shooting, he was connecting somehow the act of shooting a puck with being beaten.
What does that mean to link an emotion, a long past trauma, to something happening now, to his hockey game? He would link them in the same sentence, or he'd switch ideas? What do you mean, link?
The word link takes a lot of different forms, and in this case, with this patient, he would begin to suddenly and abruptly change topic and begin to speak about some of these abusive practices after he was talking about the symptom of shooting the puck and of what it felt like to be on the ice shooting the puck. I would focus him in at times on the emotion that he might be feeling as he was winding up to shoot the puck, and he would blank out or stop abruptly in the middle of talking about this. I would ask him, you know, what's happening? What's coming into your head right now? And then he would begin to talk about some of the beatings that had occurred. And what I began to realize was that when he began to feel in my room with me the anxiety connected with shooting a puck, it reminded him of the same anxieties that he would feel when being approached by his father about to be hit.
So once you established this association, or you started digging up this association, did his game improve?
His game began to improve slowly and gradually at first, but in something of fits and starts. And what was happening by this time was that he would return to the ice, return to the game, and begin to shoot, and become more aware that he would be beginning to face these kinds of anxieties, that instead of talking to him about suppressing or pushing away at the moment of the game, I was inviting him to allow himself to feel the anxiety that would be coming up, to get more comfortable with the anxiety, in a sense, that would naturally be coming up for him. And then he would either be successful or unsuccessful, somewhat sporadically, and then he would come back in to sessions or telephone me afterwards and talk to me more about what his experience was like. And so in deepening ways, we began to uncover and understand more and more deeply about what was happening with him emotionally as he was in the middle of playing hockey, and how much of this would of the particular experience connected with and correlated with earlier past experiences, so that once enough work was done, he didn't have to think anymore. He went back to being able to feel just in the flow of the game itself, and things became automatic for him again, and he once again reacquired the shot that had been missing from him.
I'm thinking that what's so different about what you do is that it's psychoanalysis. I mean, in the general cliche of sports psychology, analysis equals paralysis. Just do it. You know, don't think too much. Right? You're supposed to be helping athletes sustain the flow of their game. Do you have to fight that?
Actually, that's one of the larger misconceptions about modern psychoanalysis, that it involves overthinking. What I'm essentially trying to do is to remove the obstacles, the emotional obstacles, from an athlete patient that are getting in the way of him being able to be in the flow of the game without thinking. So in fact, I would think that that what I'm doing differently is, instead of saying to the athlete, just consciously suppress any kind of negative emotion, I'm saying, let's open it up, let's learn, understand, and think about in as much depth as we can what the impeding emotions are, so that you can return and be even freer. Because this way has a more likely way of being able to really help you deal automatically with those impediments without worrying about consciously suppressing something that, you might not be able to.
Have you treated many athletes who can no longer do their signature shot or move, as was the case with this athlete, make the slap shot or dunk the basketball or throw a strike?
That's one of the major symptoms that people will come to me with. Right. Part of what I'm thinking, or of how I'm thinking about these kinds of things, is that an athlete has particularly enhanced capacities to what I call dissociate himself or herself from his or her life in general. An athlete goes out into the court or onto the playing field and is not immersed emotionally or cognitively in the thinking about day-to-day life events, family, kids, investments in today's world, endorsements, and so on. An athlete that's performing successfully can block all of that out almost automatically, but if not, can be helped to be trained to block things out automatically, to feel in the flow of the game. And my experience has been that what's happening with these, with certain higher skilled athletes and professional athletes, that they, for some reason, lose the capacity and the ability to do that, to do something that helps them dissociate from the rest of their life in a way that helps them be in the flow. And this isn't only, I'm finding, limited to athletes, but it's also certain other people that are in high-pressure jobs, business CEOs, entrepreneurial types, surgeons, people that require that sort of intense focus and almost being lost in what they're doing. And when people feel like they're losing their edge, my experience has been that, that something is happening unconsciously that they're not fully aware of, that's coming up in what I call bad dissociative ways, so that they can't concentrate, can't be in the flow, feel fogged out, feel blank, like they're blanking out, feel like they've lost their aggressive edge. Something's happening in their mind to interfere with the ability to dissociate well.
I'm curious how much your patients talk with you about superstitiousness, or admit to it, or find it a problem.
It's a large part of a player's repertoire. I think that prior to and leading up to a game can be a very potentially frightening emotional experience that a player will experience as excitement or experience as jitters or butterflies or something of that sort. But what they're feeling is a sense of vulnerability. They're feeling a sense of fear, and they're feeling a sense of an out-of-controlness that they need to somehow reestablish control over. And superstitions are often obsessive rituals or functions designed to help them feel more in control of the things that they're feeling most out of control of at that moment. The place where that gets to be a problem is when the defense itself, when the superstition or when the obsessive ritual itself begins to interfere with the preparation or the playing of the game.
So can you give us an example from your recent practice?
a hockey goalie will come in at a very specific and particular time. He has to be the first one in. He feels a mounting sense of tension, nausea, anxiety, and excitement as he gets closer to the rink. He spreads out his equipment in a particular way, puts on his left sock before his right sock, puts on his right pad before his left pad. Everything is done in a particular sequence and in a particular order, and he pats himself and checks his equipment in exactly the precise order that he needs to do before each, he can go out comfortably before each game begins. That's one of the milder ones that is probably pretty much known and well-known commonly. Once he's out on the ice, there's a team ritual after the warm-up then of certain and specific individuals just before the puck drops having to be in a particular order in front of him to pat him on the pads before they return back to the bench or to the face-off circle, so that it's not only a ritual that involves the goalie, but the goalie involves the other teammates in the same ritual.
Is everyone okay with this?
Very cool with it.
My guest is Michael Miletic. He's a psychoanalyst who specializes in treating professional and elite amateur athletes. He's been a psychiatric consultant to several NHL teams and the Detroit Pistons. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're back with psychoanalyst Michael Miletic. He specializes in treating professional and amateur athletes. Let's talk about a specific case in hockey, and I'm thinking of the recent example of Marty McSorley. He's the Boston Bruins defenseman who's accused of assault for slashing a Vancouver player in the head with his stick during a game. This is McSorley, a player whose specialty really was his, or is his, aggressiveness. He's used strategically by his coach, by his team, in that way. McSorley claims that what he did this night in question in February was no different than what he does almost every game. And it's raised questions about excessive aggressiveness, specifically in hockey, but throughout professional sports, and raises the question where you draw the line. Once you're in the zone, in the game, are there different rules that apply than would off the ice?
Well, your question covers a lot of different areas, from a legal to an ethical to a psychological one, so it's difficult to know where to begin with that one.
What are your impressions of the case?
Well, my sense, I didn't hear the quote that you just mentioned, that this is something he does no different from anything else that he does in any game, because from my reading, at least, of a number of quotes, he had been deeply apologetic and felt that this had been out of character for him in some way, as far as his explanation went, that a premeditated attack such as this was something that he felt out of control of, and what he thought was not part of his usual aggressive game. Now, I had not spoken with him, nor have I spoken with people close to him, so I can't know for sure. But my sense of putting things together and putting the events together as I understood them and followed them had to do with his feeling earlier on, both beaten up physically in the fight, but I think even more importantly, in terms of what might have provoked this kind of egregious act, was that he was taunted by the player that had beaten him up.
Are you often in the position then of, and I would imagine it's a difficult balancing act, of treating athletes like McSorley in a sport, hockey, in which the norm of aggressiveness really is not normal. The norm is not the norm of the streets, but of the rink. How do you help them channel the aggressiveness or find boundaries on the rink to help them control themselves, to find a line that they're comfortable with?
Well, I think that's an important question, because the entire game depends on that. The players were outraged that McSorley had broken the rules of the game. His act diminished the game in the public's eyes. It wasn't seen as an isolated, out-of-control act by somebody who was momentarily troubled. It was seen as an indictment of the game. So, first of all, the need to establish these kind of boundaries is essential for the players, for the sport, and for all of us watching the sport.
Well, what do the hockey players that you treat, how do they talk about their moments on the rink? Because they're let loose to follow their instincts, to be in the game, not to constantly be monitoring their aggressiveness.
They're let loose to to do that, and they, in fact, have to be able to channel that aggressiveness in order to perform and function well, which makes it an even trickier question and a trickier problem. But at the same time, a part of them has to be able to have some sense of boundary or control about themselves in the same way that the playing field has lines drawn around the border of it, and in the same way that there are boards around the rink. They have to be fully in the flow of the game and in the moment of the game, but a part of them has to also be functioning as ready to take signals from themselves when they feel like they're crossing those lines. And for players that I treat, I, by necessity, who have difficulty in maintaining those boundaries, we have to get to the reasons why. What happens at those moments that they lose that capacity, that mental capacity to stay within the limits of the game?
Michael Miletic, I'd like to thank you very much for talking with me today.
It's been a pleasure.
Dr. Michael Miletic is a psychiatrist in private practice specializing in treating athletes. He's the psychiatric consultant to the Detroit Pistons and other pro teams as well. Coming up, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new CD from Steve Lacy and Roswell Rudd. This is Fresh Air.